morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. Policy: Trump's top advisor's wage campaign to shift his focus to high prices. During closed-door meetings in recent weeks, the president's aides have pressed him to calibrate his message on affordability, by Joss Dawsey and Meredith McGraw. Just before President Trump left the White House for Thanksgiving, top aides met with him in his private dining room to discuss inflation and the economy in hopes he would calibrate his message on affordability. In another meeting last month, this time in the Oval Office, aides presented Trump with surveys from one of the president's own pollsters detailing voters' concerns about the costs of living. His team has begun showing him social media posts that illustrate how Americans view the economy. Top aides have taken turns talking to their boss about his economic messaging and the need to emphasize what voters are feeling. Almost every senior White House official is involved in the effort. It is part of an across-the-White-House bid to change Trump's messaging on the economy, as many advisors worry that voters' concerns about high prices are dragging down his presidency and hurting Republicans, according to people familiar with the matter. In conversations in recent weeks, Trump's advisors have encouraged the president to talk more about what the administration is doing to increase wages, lower the cost of housing, and reduce inflation, the people said. So far, Trump has largely avoided any "I feel your pain" messaging, telling aides that the economy is strong, and he has dismissed Washington's focus on affordability as a trap set by Democrats intent on papering over the administration's economic achievements. In many of the private conversations, the people said, Trump has argued that former President Joe Biden was responsible for inflation, not him. There is this fake narrative Democrats talk about, affordability. They just say the word. It doesn't mean anything to anybody, Trump said during a meeting with his cabinet secretaries at the White House this week. The word affordability is a con job by the Democrats. The behind-the-scenes effort to press Trump to talk about affordability has been unfolding for weeks, and it started even before the Republicans faced greater-than-expected losses in last month's elections, the people said. Everyone's talking about the A word these days. Affordability is a huge issue for the White House, said Stephen Moore, an outside advisor to Trump on the economy. His numbers on the economy aren't where they should be. I believe it's a messaging problem. Economic growth, by its broadest measure, has been solid since Trump took office, but job growth has been tepid and the unemployment rate has edged up. Inflation has remained stuck around 3%. In surveys, consumers have signaled deep concern about costs and scarcer job opportunities. White House aides are reorienting some of Trump's public events to focus on costs. They are planning economy-focused speeches around the country in early 2026, the people said, and they are making plans to shift to domestic matters after Trump spent some of his first 10 months in office on foreign policy. Republicans fear big losses in the midterms next year if perception of the economy doesn't improve, administration officials and others close to Trump said. The president talked up his administration's efforts to tackle inflation during a speech to McDonald's franchise owners and suppliers last month, and this week during the cabinet meeting acknowledged more work needed to be done on inflation. On Saturday, Trump signed an executive order that establishes a new government task force to investigate whether anti-competitive behavior in the food industry is contributing to high grocery prices. It is a fact that the Biden administration created the worst inflation crisis in a generation, and President Trump and his entire administration have been working hard to actually fix it through tax cuts, deregulation, and driving down energy prices, said Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary. Leavitt and Trump calls the word affordability a con job, because Democrats are pretending to fix an issue they created. Trump won the 2024 election in part because of voter bitterness about Biden's handling of the economy and concerns about inflation. Upon taking office, the president pivoted to immigration, foreign policy, and other issues. I talked about inflation, too, but you know how many times you can say that an apple has doubled in cost? He said on Inauguration Day, arguing that immigration was a bigger motivator for voters than prices. Trump is traveling to northern Pennsylvania next week for a speech that a White House official said would focus on the administration's plans to end what the president's aides call an inflation crisis set in motion by Biden. More speeches and events focused on the economy are in the works ahead of next year's midterm election. In recent remarks, the president has pointed to investments by private companies in the U.S., tax cuts in his signature tax and spending package, and his administration's work to lower drug prices. He has also discussed $2,000 stimulus checks for many Americans that would be paid for with revenue from tariffs. John McLaughlin, a Trump pollster, said Republicans need to draw a contrast with Democrats on affordability and crime and highlight Republican-backed tax cuts. The very obvious and simple response to the affordability issue is going after Democrats who want to raise taxes, he said. The president has at times been more animated by his peacemaking efforts abroad and his plans to build a sprawling ballroom on the White House complex than by high costs, according to White House officials. Some allies have encouraged the White House to focus less on issues abroad and turn their gaze back to the U.S., where Trump's support on the economy has sagged in polling. In private, White House aides say they are concerned about falling victim to the same political pitfalls that bedeviled Biden, who at times struggled to sell a positive message on the economy without sounding dismissive of voters' angst on cost-of-living issues. Joe Manchin, the former Democratic senator who criticized Biden for dismissing inflation as transitory, said the economy has stabilized in many ways under Trump, but costs are still deeply concerning for people, he said, and should be a warning sign to the president. What they might say, it's taking longer than we anticipated, we're working very hard, we're stabilizing things, Manchin said. They don't want to recreate the same mistakes Biden made before. You can't tell me it's sunshine outside when it's raining like hell. Elections. Trump lashes out at Democrat for lack of loyalty after pardon. The president criticized Representative Henry Cuellar for filing for re-election as a Democrat after he received a pardon from the president, by Alex Leary. President Trump criticized as disloyal an indicted congressman from Texas. He pardoned last week after the lawmaker filed for re-election as a Democrat. Oh well, next time, no more Mr. Nice Guy, Trump wrote Sunday morning on social media, signaling frustration with Representative Harry Cuellar, who was charged last year along with his wife with allegedly taking nearly $600,000 in foreign bribes. Trump didn't explicitly seek a promise from Cuellar that he switch parties in exchange for the pardon, but the president expected he would, according to a person familiar with the events. Trump has been upset for days with Cuellar's decision to remain a Democrat, the person said, leading to his Sunday social media post. Trump pardoned Cuellar on Wednesday, justifying his decision by accusing former President Joe Biden of weaponizing the Justice Department against a member of his own party. Trump said Cuellar, a Democrat who represents a competitive district near the U.S.-Mexico border, had been punished for speaking out against Biden's border policies. Trump issued the pardon after receiving a letter from the Cuellar daughters. God was very happy with me then. Then it happened, Trump wrote, referring to Collier's decision to file for re-election as a Democrat on the same day that the president pardoned him. The president criticized Cuellar for continuing to work with the same radical left scum that just weeks before wanted him and his wife to spend the rest of their lives in prison. Such a lack of loyalty, something that Texas voters and Henry's daughters will not like, Trump added. Cuellar didn't immediately respond Sunday to a request for comment. Trump and Republicans face a challenging midterm election cycle next year that could jeopardize the party's control of Congress, particularly the House. Trump has been pushing his party to carve out more House seats through redistricting. A modern Democrat from Laredo, Texas, Collier has often crossed party lines to vote with Republicans. He has remained popular in his district with voters of both parties, despite the changes. The district, which Collier has represented since 2005, is one Republicans had targeted for pickup under newly drawn district maps. The primary is in March. Collier and his wife, Imelda Collier, were charged in May 2024 with conspiracy, bribery, money laundering, and other charges. The pair was accused of accepting funds from an Azerbaijani-controlled energy company and a Mexican bank in exchange for boosting their interests on Capitol Hill. Collier said that he and his wife were innocent and that he had consulted with congressional ethics officials before taking any actions. He narrowly won re-election last November. Policy: how abortion access became a major sticking point in the GOP healthcare fight. Conservative activists urge Republican senators to vote against any healthcare proposal that doesn't tighten access to the procedure. By Sabrina Siddiqui, Laura Casito, and Lindsay Wise. As congressional Republicans weighed how to approach the fight over extending Affordable Care Act subsidies, powerful anti-abortion groups saw an opportunity. Led by Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, anti-abortion activists began to pressure Republicans during the fall government shutdown to further restrict abortion coverage from insurance plans made cheaper by ACA subsidies at the heart of the dispute. The activists' warning was simple. Extending subsidies without such limits was a line Republicans must not cross to keep social conservative support in next year's midterm elections. If you demotivate the pro-life voters and tell them we don't have something to offer you, it is a disaster to the Republican Party, said Frank Cannon, chief political strategist at Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America. Those lobbying efforts are now abortion access became a sticking point as Congress faces critical deadline to extend the subsidies before December 15th. The end of the open enrollment period for ACA coverage that takes effect in January. The popular healthcare subsidies expire at the year's end, and conservative activists are intensifying their campaign on Republicans to ensure that the money isn't used to indirectly fund abortions. A clash over abortion adds another layer of complexity to the continuing debate over reforming or ending the subsidies, which benefit about 20 million Americans, and further imperils the narrow prospects of reaching a deal. Republicans were already inclined to let the subsidies last, given a longtime conservative opposition to the Obamacare healthcare law. Democrats secured a promise from Republicans to hold a vote on healthcare by the second week in December in exchange for voting to end the 43-day shutdown. President Trump's advisors recently began drawing up a healthcare plan that included a 2-year extension of the subsidies, but House Speaker Mike Johnson warned the White House that most House Republicans were opposed to continuing them. I think the Republican conference really wants to find a path forward to take care of people that have no place else to go to get their health insurance, said Mike Rounds, Republican South Dakota. But he cautioned, we have never, as Republicans, ever voted to use taxpayer money to fund abortions, and we're not going to start now. The health care law, which broadened insurance access primarily through a creation of new health exchanges and an expansion of Medicaid, has been a top target of conservatives since its passage more than 15 years ago. Republicans have tried and failed to repeal the law in several high-profile fights. ACA marketplace plans can offer abortion coverage, but existing laws bars the use of federal funds towards abortion, except in cases of rape or incest or to save a mother's life. Subsidies can be used to pay for a plan that covers abortion, but enrollees have to pay a small out-of-pocket sum for the specific cost of the abortion coverage to ensure federal money isn't used for that. The anti-abortion activists argue that the subsidies indirectly fund abortion services. Democrats have proposed extending the subsidies for 3 years, as is. Republicans have yet to coalesce around their plans. But Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican South Dakota, described the existing language around abortion as one of the biggest sticking points in talks about the subsidies' futures. Other Republicans agreed. If my tax dollars are being used to be able to take human life, especially the life of an infant, I have a problem with that, said Senator James Lankford, Republican, Oklahoma. When some anti-abortion Democrats voted in 2010 for the health care law without the restrictions abortion's opponents wanted, Susan B. Anthony rallied social conservative voters against them in that year's midterm elections. Anti-abortion activists say the fight this year has similar stakes. Democrats argue that existing safeguards are sufficient and have accused Republicans of using abortion as an excuse to let the subsidies lapse and further dismantle the law. I think this is being viewed as an opportunity by anti-choice groups to try and expand a nationwide abortion ban as part of any legislation, and that's a non-starter, said Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat, New Hampshire, a key player in bipartisan talks about a possible short-term extension of the subsidies. 25 states prohibit abortion coverage in ACA marketplace plans altogether, according to the healthcare nonprofit KFF, while others either defer to insurers or require that individual plans in their state cover abortion. Democrats and their allies say prohibiting the use of subsidies to purchase plans that cover abortion would set up a conflict with states that require plans to include the coverage. Anti-abortion organizations and congressional Republicans are really trying to falsely pit affordable health care against abortion coverage, said Georgiana Usova, national director of Planned Parenthood's political arm. Monthly insurance bills for ACA enrollees are expected to more than double on average should the subsidies expire. Some GOP lawmakers, particularly those in competitive seats, have said they are concerned their party will be blamed for sharp increases in health care costs in the next year's midterms. More than half of ACA marketplace enrollees said it would have a major impact on their decision to vote in the midterms and on which party's candidates they would support if their overall health care expenses increase by $1,000 next year, according to a new KFF poll released Thursday. Most enrollees said that Congress should extend the enhanced tax credits, and about one in four indicated very likely going without insurance next year if premiums double. China. See how a Chinese invasion of Taiwan could unfold. An amphibious assault to conquer the island democracy would be one of the toughest military operations to pull off. By Naharika Mandami, Daniel Kiss, and Carl Churchill. 5 miles off Taiwan's coast, ZTD-05, amphibious vehicles roll out of ships and zip over the water amid a hail of artillery fire. Chinese soldiers inside have their orders: seize the beach or die trying. Close by, China's airborne troops are taking losses. They arrived before dawn in low-flying Y-20 aircraft to seize Taoyuan Airport. Taiwanese defenders downed several planes. The paratroopers that landed scattered are in a race to assault the airfield before Taiwan wrecks it. This hypothetical battle scenario imagines a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, as militaries, policymakers, and war gamers are doing. As amphibious invasion would be one of the toughest military operations to execute. An all-out war would be extremely bloody, devastate the global economy, and change the course of the 21st century. Whether Beijing will try to conquer the democratically governed island by force is the biggest geopolitical unknown facing the world. A close second, how the U.S., Taiwan's main defense partner, would respond. The Strait. The Taiwan Strait is a daunting obstacle. Tens of thousands of Chinese troops would need to cross it, with tanks, trucks, and more, while Taiwan's missiles and mines, and possibly U.S. bombers and submarines, target the invading fleet. The Strait can be hostile without any of that. Depending on the month, amphibious vehicles attempting to land on Taiwan would encounter some mix of typhoons, unpredictable currents, strong winds, rain, and fog. Really, really nasty. Joshua Arsogui, a U.S. Army War College expert on China's military, said of the sea conditions. The Island. Taiwan is much bigger than Okinawa and Iwo Jima, the nearby Japanese islands U.S. forces captured in gruesome World War II battles. The 1945 Battle of Okinawa was the last time a very large-scale amphibious operation happened, said Ian Easton, author of a book on a possible Taiwan fight. And that one was pretty simple compared to what an invasion of Taiwan would be. At the time, the U.S. also had extensive plans to storm Taiwan, then controlled by Japan. It aborted the effort called Operation Causeway because the scale and complexity demanded many hundreds of thousands of troops. The terrain. Mountains run the length of Taiwan's main island and line cities and beaches. Built into them are tunnels, networks, and military bases. In a fight, defenders would fire from high, concealed positions. The topography also complicates a key decision for China, where to land. If amphibious forces approach Taiwan's east coast, they would confront steep cliffs. If they land in the south, soldiers would find themselves fighting through rugged slogo terrain to Taipei. The beaches. Taiwan's beaches aren't suited for amphibious landings. Many are too small to mass a sizable force. A number of them are bordered by mountains, cities, or paddy fields, making it harder to break out of the beach perimeter. This isn't Normandy of the D-Day landings. China's options would be limited by another priority, seizing a seaport or airport, ideally both, to bring follow-on forces and bulky supplies. Only a few areas offer a beach, port, and airfield in close proximity. The cities. Most of Taiwan's 23 million people are concentrated along the coast that faces China. Taiwan is increasingly preparing to bog down Chinese forces in deadly urban combat, said K. Tristan Tang, an associate fellow at Secure Taiwan Associate Corp, a Taipei-based research group. Defenders know the cities can set up sniper positions and make it difficult for China to identify strongholds nested in the concrete, he said. Taipei. Taipei is ringed by mountains and crisscrossed by rivers. It would be heavily defended, especially against decapitation strikes, targeting key government buildings, mock-ups of which Chinese forces train on. If Chinese troops came up the Tam Sui River, Taiwan could block their path by dropping a major bridge that straddles it, said Tang. Taiwanese Marines, equipped with anti-aircraft missiles, would likely defend the city's airport. The flip side is that Beijing knows these problems better than most. A hot war isn't inevitable, but Chinese leader Xi Jinping has asked his military planners to get ready, driving a rapid peacetime buildup. Shape of the war. How would an invasion unfold? A lot would depend on what Taiwan does to fight back, whether the U.S. intervenes, and how well Chinese forces work together across the skies, seas, sand, and space. Chinese doctrine and Western experts point to three broad phases. First, China would hit Taiwan with missile barrages. Second, its ships would cross the Taiwan Strait and amphibious units would attempt to land on one or more beaches. Third, Chinese forces would break out of the landing zone and launch a ground assault for Taipei. In reality, the war would involve a dizzying array of attacks and counterattacks. China would begin by snapping up Taiwan's small outer islands. It would enforce a blockade to squeeze Taipei into submission. It could sever undersea internet cables to plunge the island into digital darkness or order crippling cyber attacks. Phase 1, firepower. China would unleash a joint firepower strike, pounding Taiwan with missiles. The goal? To soften Taiwan up by battering its defenses, make it safer for Chinese ships to cross the strait, break Taiwan's will to fight, and dissuade a U.S. intervention with a strong show of force. The campaign would likely involve hundreds of missiles falling on hundreds of targets, from Taiwan's air defense systems and air force bases, to ammunition bunkers, command hubs, and coastal artillery. The Blitz would aim to destroy warplanes on the ground, crater gunways, and discombobulate the defenders. How long the bombardment lasts, a few days or a few weeks, is a crucial decision Chinese war planners would have to make. Stretching it out could give the U.S. time to act, but failing to eliminate key capabilities could imperil the invasion's next steps. China has undertaken a dramatic buildup of missiles. The Rocket Force, which was elevated to a full military branch a decade ago, has 3,500 missiles across different ranges. It's not just the Rocket Force. China's ground forces, warships, and modern jet fighters like the J-16 would all strike Taiwan. During military drills in 2022, the Chinese Army brought the PCH-191 rocket launcher to Pingting Island, 85 miles from Taiwan. Developed over the past decade, it can throw munitions of varying ranges, including volleys of low-cost rockets. The Rocket Force would go after tough targets such as U.S.-made Patriot air defense systems. It could also attack Taiwan's underground military installation using bunker buster missiles like the DF-11AZT, said Decker Eveleth, an expert at CNA, a U.S.-based research organization. Those warheads won't destroy deeply buried facilities, but could collapse tunnel entrances, he said. The Rocket Force's Base 61 would be a key player. The brigades under it, located across from Taiwan, are growing in size and capability. One big dilemma for Beijing, whether to preemptively strike U.S. bases in the region. American warplanes flying from these bases in Japan and the U.S. territories of Guam could sink a lot of Chinese ships, but striking them would instantly put the world's top two powers in a head-to-head war. If China went after U.S. targets in Japan, it would launch a lot of missiles at once. Not just a large number, but a large variety, so that missile defenses have to cope with a different type of missile coming at different speeds from different trajectories in different directions, said Eric Heitenbotham, a principal research scientist at MIT's Security Studies Program. One of the earliest missiles would be the Dongfeng 17. Equipped with a hypersonic glide vehicle, it skims along the Earth's atmosphere and can maneuver, making it less predictable. The biggest trend in the Rocket Force has been the extension of range, Heitenbotham said. The Dongfeng 26 missile can reach Guam, a hub of American military power. It has a heck of a warhead, Heitenbotham said. It's very accurate, comes in fast, and has ferocious killing capability. Phase 2, crossing and landing. After the Blitz comes the amphibious assault. In this part of the invasion, Chinese ships would be sunk. Landing forces could be blown up in the water or cut down on beaches, and fighting akin to bloody World War II battles might unfold. How would it begin? Thousands of Chinese troops and millions of tons of warfighting equipment would move to coastal staging areas in China on trucks, trains, and planes, potentially tipping off its adversaries. If they're going to go big, and they're either going to go big or they're not going to go, it's going to take a lot of preparation. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Now continuing on with our story. Said Dennis Blasco, a former U.S. Army attaché in Beijing and Hong Kong. In the last 2 years, however, some People's Liberation Army watchers have begun to wonder if it could use the cover of military exercises to obscure the warning signs. Since 2022, Chinese drills around Taiwan have grown far more complex and realistic. If that trend intensified year after year, China could pivot to a rapid high-intensity attack, some experts said. Picking the right landing spots would be tricky. If amphibious forces headed to southern Taiwan, they might have an easier fight since Taiwan's army is concentrated in the island's north. But after that, they would have to wage a grinding overland campaign to Taipei, river by river, ridgeline by ridgeline, said Mark Kanakan, a retired colonel in the U.S. Marine Corps, who has run war games simulating such a scenario. Defenders could blow up brigades, collapse tunnels, and bog down the enemy in cities or mountains. Approaching Taiwan from the north would put the landing teams closer to Taipei, but they would meet stiff resistance on and beyond the beach from tanks, artillery, mines, and more. Taiwan would focus its counterattacks and plant booby traps on the limited pathways out of the beaches. Since a military restructuring in 2017, China has owned an A-team that would likely act as the spearhead. They are the Army's six amphibious combined arms brigades, totaling around 30,000 troops and more than 2,400 vehicles, Blasco's research shows. These forces would cross the strait on ships, launch into the water in speedy armored vehicles, and swim to the target beaches in rows. China has also rapidly built out its Marine Corps from two brigades in 2017 to 11 today, and that would execute missions in tandem or separately from the Army. The most debated question, can Chinese forces and their weapons get across the Taiwan Strait in the number they need? China's navy has dozens of amphibious ships, but not hundreds. It hasn't hugely ramped up production of the types of landing vessels that would best serve a Taiwan attack, though it could do so relatively easily in the future, being the world's top shipbuilder. Instead, it has churned out even larger warships better suited to projecting power far from China's shores. These behemoths would nonetheless be pressed into service for a Taiwan fight. To fill the gap in sea lift, China's military would lean on a secondary source, civilian ships. Take, for instance, roll-on, roll-off ferries that typically carry passengers, trucks, and cargo, but are now built to defense standards and train with the military. These large ships have modified ramps that can drop down until submerged, allowing armored vehicles to roll out into the water, said Michael Dam, a retired U.S. Navy intelligence officer and senior resident fellow at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. The stern ramps can withstand heavy water and weight, he said. The main challenge would be scaling up for a conflict in which they would need to convoy in close formation under the protection of warships sailing alongside, Dam said. Phase 3, break out and seize Taipei. A successful beach assault offers a foothold. After that, however, waves of soldiers, potentially hundreds of thousands, need to follow to break out off of the beach, push deeper, and take Taipei. Their equipment, such as heavy battle tanks and truckloads of bullets, fuel, and medical supplies, can't swim ashore. The best way is a port. If they take a port, it's kind of game over, said Thomas Shugart, an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. That is because China could then bring in civilian ferries, deck cargo ships, and other commercial vessels. These would be loaded up with warfighters and large volumes of logistics needed for a ground campaign. The vast majority of their sea lift is going to be commercial stuff, and its supply is near limitless, said Shugart. This is Taiwan's nightmare. To avoid it, its forces could sabotage its ports to keep them out of Chinese hands, or sink ships in the channel to block access. This year, another capability showed up on the Chinese coast. Mobile piers that can be used to unload directly onto a beach or possibly to a damaged port. This setup consists of three barges that line up one behind the other close to the shore. Each has retractable legs that thrust down into the seabed to hold the ships in position. Once steadied, long bridges extend out, connecting one barge to the other, the first barge to the shore, research by Dam and Shugart shows. The result is a 2,700-foot causeway where ferries or civilian cargo ships can pull up. Trucks, tanks, and tactical vehicles would roll out to the bridge and onto Taiwan, possibly hundreds at a time. These piers would be vulnerable to attack, though, which means they could only be used once a beach was secured. If China got to a large force ashore, it would move on Taipei, waging a 21st century battle for a megacity. U.S. small Minnesota town defends Somali residents as critical to the economy. A sweeping fraud scandal has put the spotlight on places like Wilmar, where the Somalis run businesses and work at the Jenny O. Turkey Plant, by Joe Barrett. Nearly 30 years ago, in this small agricultural town, resident Pablo Obregon did a double take at a group waiting for the bus downtown on the first day of school. They were Somali children. "Where did they come from?" he recalls wondering. Obregon, now Wilmar's director of community growth, is no longer surprised when he sees large numbers of Somalis. "So many have settled here that a lively stretch downtown is called Little Mogadishu because Somalis run more than a dozen storefront businesses. In winter, it isn't uncommon to see Somalis in traditional dress bundled up in big American-style parkas and stocking caps worn over hijabs. Somalis represent about a quarter of production workers at the Jenny O Turkey Plant, the economic engine of this community of nearly 22,000, some 95 miles west of Minneapolis. But in recent days, downtown's strip of restaurants, groceries, and clothing stores has been attracting only a few customers, shopkeepers say. ICE raids are ramping up in Minnesota, and President Trump has lashed out against immigrants from Somalia, calling them garbage and saying he doesn't want them in the U.S. They are not willing to go to work and not coming outside a lot because of fear, said Abdiweli Youssef, a 33-year-old Somali-American, as he swept up the grocery store he owns with family members. He wore a traditional robe-like kameez under a long wool coat and a pink stocking cap against the below-zero wind chill, which he didn't seem to mind. "Minnesota is the most welcoming place in America," he said. "I have five kids who were born here in Wilmar hospitals. This is our forever home." Many here and across Minnesota have been shaken by a sprawling fraud scandal that has put the state's Somali community in the national spotlight and drawn Trump's ire. Federal prosecutors say dozens of people bilked taxpayers by setting up scam social service companies. It has hit home here. A Minneapolis man pleaded guilty in February to fraud that included using the address of a Wilmar restaurant to claim that he fed 1.6 million meals to children early in the pandemic, according to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Minnesota. Local leaders say the scandal doesn't reflect the Somali community broadly. "I can honestly say I haven't encountered any bad Somalis," said Wilmar Mayor Doug Reese. "I mean, there's probably some, but by and large, they're good people." When Reese, a former union official, moved to the area in 1972, the city was made up mostly of descendants of Swedes, Norwegians, Dutch, and Germans, he said. The first big wave of more recent migrants was Hispanic farm workers. Raleigh Nissen, a 79-year-old former shoe salesman and longtime Republican leader in the area, said he appreciated the inflow of cash from the newcomers. "I have no problem with them because when they got paid, they would come to my store and buy cowboy boots," he said. Nissen did express reservations, however, after the Somalis started to arrive in relatively large numbers. In 2019, after Trump issued an executive order requiring states and counties to formally consent to continue receiving refugees, Cahuilla County, where Willmar is the county seat, wrestled with the decision. Nissen, then chair of the county board, said people wanted a pause in refugees but were afraid to say so out of fear of being labeled racist. He cited concerns from constituents about the overburdened social services in the area, according to local radio coverage of the meeting. In the end, the county became the first in Minnesota to say they wanted to continue, but only in a 3-2 vote. Nissen was one of the two no votes. Today, Nissen said he has a very good Somali friend and drives two Somali children to school in his part-time job as a bus driver. He feels the president's comments go too far. "It's not just the Somalis who are raiding the bank," he said. "It's a broad brush, and I don't think he should be painting with a broad brush. We should get rid of the people who are here illegally, not ship everybody back to Somalia or Mexico or Venezuela." The Somalis arriving in the past few decades have changed the face of downtown, renting apartments and opening businesses in the storefronts. Some display colorful clothing and rugs, and many of the restaurants serve a traditional Somali spiced tea with steamed milk and lots of sugar. "They are very entrepreneurial," said Obregon, Willmar's community growth director. Now Hispanic and Somali children make up the majority of children at the local school. Vicki Davis, a city council member and parateacher in special education, said her first grade class of 22 students has only 4 white children, including 1 Ukrainian. "It's fun to see them play together," she said. "One of the Somali girls' hijabs will fall off, and all the other girls are like, 'Okay, my goodness, let's help her.' It's just really sweet." Sending Somalis out of the country would be a blow to Willmar's economy, officials said. "Well, first thing I think of is Jenny O," said Mayor Reese. "They aren't going to have workers, right? And I don't know where you'd find them." "Somalis are an important part of the plant's strong culture," said Hunter Pagel, head of human resources at the plant, which is owned by Hormel Foods. "We would struggle if we didn't have the team members working on the floor," he said. "There's only so much you can automate. There's something about the human touch. They do a better job." Streetwise, why NVIDIA and other AI stocks have lost their quality status. A popular ETF dropped big tech stocks, which gets at an important issue. Is the bet on artificial intelligence a vast potential profit pool or a money pit? By James McIntosh. Are the big AI companies giving up their real status as the highest caliber stock in the market? The question is at the heart of a debate about quality companies that has left two popular ETFs with wildly different performances after one ditch NVIDIA and most of the rest of big tech. The $48 billion iShares MSCI U.S. Quality Factor, ticker QUAL, and Invesco's $15 billion S&P 500 Quality, SPHQ, specialize in what the investment industry has dubbed quality companies. The exchange-traded funds invest only in companies that show they are safe and steady on financial measures, including high profitability and low leverage. The benchmarks that these two EFTs use to measure quality have a crucial difference, which leads to one having much more exposure to the major artificial intelligence stocks. QAL, which bases its definition of quality on an MSCI index, has almost a third of its holdings in five of the leading eight big tech stocks. SPHQ, which is based on an S&P index, holds only one, Apple. The result has been wild swings in performance. Up to June, when Invesco dropped NVIDIA, SPHQ beat QUAL by the most in any six-month period. In the past 6 months, SPHQ has lagged behind by the most, aside from the period immediately after QUAL got going in 2013. Uncertain quality. The iShares U.S. Quality ETF lagged behind, then beat Invesco's this year by record amounts. This much more than a semantic debate between ETFs about what quality means. It goes to the heart of a much bigger question in the markets. Is the bet on AI being made by the country's biggest companies a vast potential profit pool or a money pit that should be sounding alarm bells? In addition to NVIDIA, SPHQ dropped Meta and Netflix in June, then Microsoft last December. The culprit, according to Nick Calavas, head of factor and equity ETF strategy at Invesco, was the accounting concept of accruals. Accruals are a way to gauge how much of reported earnings are based on sales that generate cash right away, rather than money owed by customers in the future or other non-cash items. Cash today is obviously preferable to a promise that money will come through in the future. Things can go wrong, customers go bust, economies change. The S&P index behind the fund uses accruals as one of its three indicators because high accruals are sometimes a sign of trouble ahead. You start to see a deterioration in the cash component of earnings, and that might indicate that your strength and the durability of your earnings might be coming under pressure, Calavas said. In NVIDIA's case, there has been a jump in working capital as rapid sales growth has led to immediate costs, while payments from customers lag behind. In the latest quarter, money owed by customers known as accounts receivable left by $16 billion from the year before to $33 billion, while money owed to suppliers, accounts payable, rose only $33 billion to $8 billion. The gap between the two has to be funded by the company while it waits to be paid. Qual's index doesn't exclude stocks based on accruals, instead looking for steady earnings growth, which these big tech names have in spades. MSCI, which runs the index behind the fund, consulted customers about adding accruals last year, but decided against the move after finding it would lead to more churn in the stocks that qualify. Rising accruals may be part of the problem that the market began worrying about a few weeks ago. Big tech companies are pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into AI without a clear path to profit, eating into their cash on hand and increasingly needing borrowing to finance it. Investing real money now and hoping for payments sometime in the future is the core of investment, but big companies rarely spend so much on a technology where uncertainties are so high. Wei Li, chief investment strategist at the BlackRock Investment Institute, thinks there is still more to go in the bull market, but she said the uncertainties are so big it isn't even worth trying to forecast how much more productivity and so adoption and profit AI might lead to. We spend first and we're hoping that some point revenue will come, she said, but that hasn't happened yet. Quality stocks don't usually come with so much uncertainty about where they allocate their capital. But it's also undeniable that Nvidia and most other big tech stocks have been exceptionally profitable as the AI boom intensified. The accruals happening here aren't the sort of accruals that make investors the most nervous. Forensic accountants worry about rising accruals as a sign of earnings manipulation or fraud, but that isn't the concern here. Helen Jewell, chief investment officer for fundamental equities at BlackRock, uses an accruals-like measure, cash conversion, as part of stock selection, and said the point is to identify companies able to get into a virtuous cycle of investment. If you have got strong earnings and cash flow, it allows you to continuously reinvest, she said. That investment makes more money, allowing more investment, and so on. A separate academic finding used by neither ETF has long established that when companies splurge on capital spending, as the AI firms are now, their shares typically lag behind the rest of the market in the future. Investment strategists have been rediscovering the depressing historical link recently. Yet all this effort might be beside the point, said Mandum Medhat, research director at Dimensional Fund Advisors. He argues that there's no need to overcomplicate quality gauges. A strategy of just buying the most profitable stocks trading at lower valuations on average beat combined measures with accruals, stability of earnings, or other tricks. Outside the smallest companies, such a strategy already captures any gains from avoiding high capex stocks, he says. Put simply, don't buy bad companies and don't buy the most expensive companies. For me, the point of any quality approach is to spot strong companies where management resists the temptation to throw money at the latest fad. AI is definitely in fashion and management is throwing money at it. Investing based on factors aims to deliver a small premium that adds up over time. The problem with today's markets is that a handful of stocks are so big that including them or not can deliver or miss out on years of these gains in a few months. The result is that which ETF does better from here depends on investor appetite for AI, at least as much as it does on quality. National Security. Hegseth defends Pentagon strike on drug boat survivors. The Defense Secretary makes his first detailed public remarks about the operation. By Lara Seligman. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth defended the U.S. military's decision to kill two survivors of a lethal strike in the Caribbean in a follow-up attack on the capsized boat in his first detailed public remarks about the operation. During the September 2nd strike, the first of the President Trump's campaign against alleged drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific, a U.S. military aircraft struck a boat carrying 11 people that Pentagon officials had identified as drug traffickers. Hegseth himself gave the order to strike, the Defense Secretary said Saturday at the Reagan National Defense Forum in Simi Valley. As the boat burned, Hegseth left the room about 5 minutes after the strike, he said. A couple of hours later, he said he was told that the commander, Navy Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley, had ordered a second strike because there were several survivors who could still be in the fight. Hegseth said he was told the survivors may have had access to radio and could have linked up with another drug smuggling boat, and that the narcotics were still in the area and their survivors were actively interacting with them. Hegseth said he agreed with how Bradley had conducted the operation. I said, Roger, sounds good, Hegseth said. From what I understood then and what I understood now, I fully support that strike. I would have made that same call myself. Hegseth denied that at any point he told the operators to kill everybody on board. The Washington Post reported last month that Hegseth gave a spoken directive to kill everybody aboard. The details of the September 2nd operation have been at the center of a controversy over whether the second strike, which killed two survivors, constituted a war crime. Hegseth is also under fire in a Pentagon Inspector General review, which concluded that he violated department regulations when he shared sensitive information about a U.S. military operation in Yemen on Signal. Asked whether he would do the same thing again if he had the chance, Hegseth said, I don't live with any regrets. It's not a healthy way to live. Following the first September 2nd boat strike, the two survivors struggled to flip a remnant of their capsized boat over the course of an hour and waved as an aircraft passed overhead, according to lawmakers and other people briefed on the attack. Some lawmakers said the man appeared helpless with no weapons or communications devices. Bradley said in closed-door testimony this week that the attack was justified because the survivors could have been signaling to other vessels to help them finish their drug run, although he noted a surveillance drone detected no other boats in the immediate vicinity, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. No drugs were visible in the video. Bradley, however, told lawmakers that he believed the remnant of the boat concealed submerged packages of cocaine. Unless destroyed, the drugs and the men could conceivably float to a nearby shore or vessel and continue their mission, he said, according to people familiar with the briefing. Hegseth said Saturday the Pentagon is reviewing whether to publicly release the video that was shared with Congress. Trump has said he would be open to doing so. Media. Trump says Netflix-Warner deal could be a problem. The president adds, I'll be involved in the decision on the $72 billion agreement. By Alex Leary and Joe Flint. President Trump said Netflix's $72 billion deal to acquire Warner Brothers could be a problem because it would result in a large market share for the streaming giant, signaling possible government resistance in his first public comments about the sale. They have a very big market share, Trump said Sunday night of Netflix, and when they have Warner Brothers, that share goes up a lot, he added. I'll be involved in that decision. Trump, who spoke to reporters before a Kennedy Center event, also praised Netflix co-chief executive Ted Sarandos and said that they met last week in the Oval Office. I have a lot of respect for him. He's a great person. He's done one of the greatest jobs in the history of movies and other things, Trump said. But it is a big market share, and there's no question about it. It could be a problem. His remarks raise new questions about the path forward for the deal, which regulators are expected to review, but fell short of outright condemnation. On Friday, Netflix agreed to acquire Warner Brothers after the entertainment company splits its studios and HBO Max streaming business from its cable networks, beating rival bidders Paramount and Comcast. The deal stunned Hollywood, where many assumed David Ellison's Paramount was the most likely suitor. Trump advisors, including White House officials, are concerned about the deal, a senior administration official said last week. The transaction is expected to be investigated by the Justice Department, which has already begun considering how the tie-up would further cement Netflix's dominance in the media industry. Netflix and HBO Max together would control around 30% of the U.S. subscription streaming marketplace. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.